Welcome to the Legal Nurse Podcast, where you'll get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside the legal nurse consulting business. They'll share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with over 30 years' experience. So join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's your host, Pat Iyer.
Hi, this is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast. Today, we are talking to Dana Pope, who is a professional speaker, a published writer, and a published songwriter. She is a philologist, as defined as a love of words or a desire to know the origin and construction of language. Dana and I were probably in the same group growing up, which was the Language Patrol group, which involved an immediate feedback. If I misused a word, my family, particularly my parents, straightened me out quickly. And Dana has, for the desire to learn, has studied the dictionary and the World Book Encyclopedia when she was a teenager. For those of you who don't remember the World Book Encyclopedia, which graced my home, it was a set of books that were sold by traveling salesmen well before the internet, and it was where you went when you wanted to look up information about something. Dana and I agree in this statement, there's always something to learn. She is a creator of business systems for startup companies and companies that need a turnaround. And she accomplishes this by working with businesses on their distribution process, financial planning, trend analysis, inventory flow, management and employee practices, all in an effort to improve gross margins. And she also attributes networking marketing as providing the knowledge needed for success. Dana and I met at a meeting for C-suite advisors, which is an organization headed by Jeffrey Haislett, a multimedia television podcast radio show conglomerate that supports people in the C-suite. Dana, welcome to the show. I'm glad that you could be with me today.
Well, thank you so much, Pat. You know, I love talking to you, and I'm so excited that you asked me to be part of this.
Let's get right into the questions that I have as I think about your topic of the meaning of words. You write about something that I think that we take for granted until it's missing, which is the value of having a common language. Can you tell us how that relates to the medical field?
I sure can. So communication is the interchange of words. So we speak, somebody understands us, we've communicated. But when we don't understand what each other are saying, there is no communication. So you're talking to someone who speaks a foreign language and you don't understand what they're saying. This is like when the definitions of words change and we didn't realize there was a change in definition. So that creates lack of communication. So when what a word meant long ago may not mean the same now, and as we change the definitions, we get farther and farther away from being able to communicate. Well, yes, that happens every day, but imagine what it would happen in the medical field, someplace where a decision has to be made right now. Someone's life depends on it. So if you were in an emergency room, you would see many, many people surrounding a patient, and each person has their own job to do. Someone does the airway, someone does vitals, gets blood samples. Everybody has their own job to do. And seconds count, so there's no time to stop and ask a question. So when the nurses and the technicians know what they're being told to do, they get right to it. So if the doctor says, get on the chest, they know it means chest compressions. If the doctor says cross table, that means he wants x-rays shot left to right and top to bottom. Or he says BMP, CBC, cardiac enzymes, those are all tests. No one has to stop and say to the doctor, now, what does that stand for? Or what does that mean? They know the language, so they just go about and do it. And that kind of gives you a really good example of how vital it is that we have a common language.
Yes, and I think you highlighted something that the legal nurse consultants listening to this podcast understand very well, which is miscommunication is the number one reason why medical errors occur. And that encompasses things like not speaking the same language or hearing an order. For example, a nurse takes a verbal or a telephone order from a physician and doesn't repeat it back and has misheard it and carries out an order that was incorrect. Or language barriers between the patient and the physicians and the nurses, between the nurses. There are multiple opportunities for people to misunderstand each other in a complex field like medicine.
Correct. And you don't always work with the same people either. So if you have a common language, what this doctor says will most likely be very close to what this doctor says because you have all of the same terms.
You mentioned something earlier that's fascinating to me. My husband is from India and goes back to India probably, you know, like once every 15, 20 years. When he starts speaking his native language, some of his family recognize that he has not caught up with the introduction of slang or idioms or changes in meaning that are occurring in his native language because of living in the United States. So tell us, how do definitions of words change and how does our language keep changing?
Okay, so you brought up a good point because there is changes in culture, changes in slang happening all the time. So we would expect those definitions to change or even creation of new words. So like for instance, when I say the word crib, a baby boomer will think it's a baby's bed, but a millennial will think that it's a place that anyone can live. It's a new definition that has been added. That's just a really simple example of what can happen there. But let's look at how it can really affect us today. Let's take, for instance, documents that were written long ago, like the Declaration of Independence. The definitions have changed from then to now. Originally, Thomas Jefferson was asked to draft the Declaration because he had such an expertise in his language that he was able to write in a succinct, clear manner. So he chose each word deliberately and each sentence was accurately placed. He wanted to write it in such a way that the message would be understood by everyone so that our country would have no doubt what it means. But we tend to go in now and try to interpret what something means using our definitions instead of using the intent of the document at the time it was written. So if each word, each phrase is exact in the Declaration of Independence, we need to actually interpret it that way. So let's take a sentence, for instance. There's the one, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Well, Webster states that self-evident means it produces certainty or clear conviction. So in our minds, we'll know exactly what it means. So Jefferson is saying that we hold these truths to be self-evident. He's saying the next thing that's coming is the basis of what is. And that next thing is all men are created equal. So knowing that the words are specifically picked, we can understand what's being said. It means all men, women, children, gender, age, color, race, religion, sexual orientation, the rich, the poor, the bullied, everybody. It's everyone. Our founding fathers took care of it so that we would know how to regard each person. That being so, then why are we making laws for people who are being bullied? Why are we making special laws for people with financial class, religious beliefs, and so on and so on and so on? We don't need to, because we've already taken care of that. The Declaration does that for everyone. And because we've lost the intent of what the Declaration says, we spend a lot of time creating laws and a lot of work doing things that aren't necessary if we were to just follow what the document actually said.
Well, you know, that's a really good point, because all men are created equal. In the time that Jefferson was involved in that document, lived in a society in which there were slaves who were not created equal and had no voting rights and were not treated as other people were. So we have spent a lot of time in our culture trying to make sure that discrimination in whatever form doesn't exist, instead of going back and looking at what you just said, that the baseline is that we are supposed to believe people are created equal.
Correct. And most of the congressmen that signed the document were Republican, or they call them Republicans or whatever back then, who were against slavery. So they were moving that way. They just hadn't got there yet.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk about a term that you discuss in the book that you've written, and we'll talk about the book at the end as well. And that was the term relativism. Can you tell us what that means and how it would apply to the legal world?
Okay, that is a word that has become more and more popular as we keep going on. So relativism is the belief that different things are true for different people. So you'll hear somebody say sometimes, this is my truth. So every single person would have their own truth. Well, if we look at the definition of truth, as Webster said in the 1828 dictionary, which was the first American dictionary, he defines truth as the real state of things, its exactness, a verified or indisputable fact. It's what really is or what really happened. So it cannot be changed. If it's capable of being changed, it wouldn't be the truth. So relativism is coming in and saying, well, but truth is relevant to each person. Well, it's impossible. How can your truth be different from my truth, be different from the truth of someone else? Truth can't be changed. So it's actually bringing in a term that is impossible to achieve. I know you have the example in here. You wanted me to give you an example of it. And how relativism would work. Let's say a woman is raped. Now, how relativism works in this situation is the man likes to have combative sex with the woman, so he thinks he's not doing rape. The woman doesn't want to have sex and is forced to anyway. She sees it as rape. So his reality is he enjoys what he's doing, and hers is she's violated. So under relativism, there would be no court case. How can there be? If he lived out his truth, there's no rape, there would be no need for a court case. The action is different by each person. He did no wrong. He can't go to court. It's his reality. The woman, she doesn't get her reality because she was raped. But under relativism, it's saying everybody has their own truth. How can the woman and the man both get their reality, both get their truth? Well, they can't. So the term in itself is impossible to even achieve.
The whole aspect of truth is something that underlines the legal world. There are attorneys who talk about trying to determine what happened. You know, for example, a driver runs a red light and hits another car broadside. There's video cameras that capture that to show the truth of what happened. But attorneys will develop a theory of the case and take the facts and then put the facts within their theory of the case to help explain their position in a situation. We spend a lot of time as legal nurse consultants and as expert witnesses talking about truths about what happened. We talk about opinions about what happened. And the interesting aspect of our field is that you have two people who are expert witnesses who take the same set of facts and they form different opinions about what happened. So how can we reconcile that?
That's a really good question. Because we are all having our own point of view, like you said, we're putting our opinions in there, it's difficult to decide what is the truth. And one of the movies that did an excellent job about this is called A Point of View. And it's a case where there's an assassination on a government official, it might have been the president, and it shows the police or the Secret Service going around and trying to put together what had happened. And they have something like 8 witnesses. And every witness's story was different because of their point of view, where they were standing, what their beliefs are. I mean, it was amazing how everybody saw something, but they all saw something different. It wasn't until the Secret Service were able to find out what is the truth in what everybody is saying that coincides together to get at the core of what really happened. And that's how they were able to solve the case.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine that if a judge had relativism, so they actually would make sentences or conclusions based on the truth as they see it, what would happen to our courts? And that's what basically we're asking our judges to do, is to pass judgments. If there is no truth, then come up with something that could be true. And so the judges don't even have anything firm to stand on. Like we go back to the Declaration of Independence, that's a solid, firm piece of paper that we can follow. But now we're saying, no, the definition today means this, and then next month it means this. And the judge has to make a decision. How can they when they don't have any foundation to base it on? And so we're really hurting the ability for our judges to do their jobs.
I've testified for 25 plus years, and I can tell when I walk in a courtroom whether the judge likes the attorneys who are present, dislikes the attorneys, has some kind of a grudge or some kind of history involving one of them. The decisions and the rulings seem to be influenced in ways that amazed me by the personal perceptions of the judges. And certainly not all in all cases, but I could spot it as soon as it started unfolding in front of me by the nonverbal body language, by the judge's tone, by the rulings that he or she made. So I understand when you talk about having judges interpreting laws based on their own framework, they also interpret laws and make decisions based on their relationships with the attorneys that they've seen in the courtroom over and over again.
Correct, and it's scary, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I watched an attorney from New York come into a New Jersey courtroom. He had never tried a medical malpractice case before, and he wasn't completely clear on all the procedures. And the judge said to him in the 8 hours I was in the courtroom, probably at least 4 times, she said, "Now, sir, this is the way that we do it in New Jersey." Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was like a little club that she picked up and whacked him with every time he stepped slightly out of line. Before I continue with the show, I want to share a resource specifically created to help you write professional LNC reports. That's my free online training called Get More Clients with Professional LNC Reports. Imagine how great you'll feel when you can use the techniques I'll cover to start delivering highly polished and more professional-looking reports that represent you at your very best. You can access this free training at this link, http://lnc.tips/professional-lnc. That link is http://lnc.tips/professional-lnc. And start learning as soon as you finish listening to this podcast.
See, and so now we're not getting to the truth. We're doing relativism, which is their own case of how they handle things.
Mm-hmm. What about half-truths? Tell us, what are they?
Half-truths, that's fun. So if you were to look in Webster's original dictionary, that word or phrase is not there. Back then, when someone spoke, they either told the truth or they told a lie. It was one or the other. So since it's not in Webster's dictionary, I can't look at that. But in our dictionary, we do have today, a half-truth is a statement that is only partially true. It's a statement that mingles truth and falsehood with the deliberately intend to deceive someone. So it's meant to be deceptive. So usually when we choose to not tell the truth or do a half-truth, as they say, is for three reasons. One, we want to deceive. Two, if we told the truth, someone might not like us. And three, it's not what the person wants to hear. So we tell a half-truth. So in the definition of a half-truth, part of the sentence is true, but part of it is false to intentionally deceive someone. So truth cannot be changed. It stands as it is. So if you now put a sentence with part that is true and add something that is not true, something that is not true is false, which makes the statement a lie. It's just there. A half-truth is there to make us look better, to make us be able to get away with something or to deceive someone. It's not truth at all.
How does it relate to a white lie?
A white lie, I have not studied on that specifically, but I think that is the part of where it's a white lie, you do it to bring pleasure to someone. Hey, honey, do my jeans make me look fat? No, they don't.
Dangerous.
We don't want to hurt their feelings, you know. Mm. So it's kind of like a clean or a pleasant half-truth.
Okay. Can you give us an example of a documentary that illustrates the point that you're making about half-truths?
Okay, and relativism too.
Mm-hmm.
So there was actually a case that happened in 2015. It was Stephen Avery was accused of killing Teresa Halbach. He was convicted and is now serving his sentence in jail. So his lawyers decided to create a documentary showing that he was actually framed for the murder. So what they did is on the documentary, they only showed one side, which was Stephen's side. The intent was to pull at the heartstrings of people who would believe it, since they're only being fed one side of the information. And it worked. I saw people watching the documentary. I watched it. You know, you're thinking, oh, this poor man, he was framed by the police. So that was the plan that the lawyers wanted to use to manipulate the people's feelings so that they would be able to get Stephen released. What they didn't show was all the evidence that proved Stephen did do it. And there was tons of it, from DNA, from fingerprints, from the weapon in itself. And the one you can't get around is his cousin, Stephen's cousin, who was also present at the time of the murder, said that Stephen did do it. So, you know, there's the other side you gotta weigh in too. So in this case, or in any of the cases, the truth can't be different based on Stephen's truth and based on the police force's truth. They have to figure out what is really true. Now, the truth that we know is that Teresa Halbach is dead, but we have to get down to the truth of how she died. And that's taking all these puzzle pieces and putting it together to see how they actually do work together, and that would bring you down to what happened.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting case, and the documentary was fascinating, but it was manipulation.
There were a couple of people in my coaching program from the state in which the murder occurred who went to a conference that was put on by some attorneys in Wisconsin to discuss this case. And they had flocks and flocks of attorneys who were drawn to this program to find out the truth of what happened with Stephen Avery and the accusations against him. So it certainly was a hot topic.
It was a very hot topic. And even today, if you mention this case to police officials, they probably know of the case because there was just so much going on. It's a great example of, you know, the legal system and what we need to be doing to get at the right information.
And in the legal system, there is a term called punitive damages, which are designed to punish people who are guilty of what the legal world calls egregious behavior. It's wanton, willful, almost malicious behavior that's deliberately designed to deceive. Has the word egregious always had that meaning?
It has not. And that does happen with some of our words. So egregious actually had two meanings in the beginning in Webster's dictionary. So his first definition meant it was actually a positive meaning for the word. It means eminent, remarkable, extraordinary, distinguished. But this is not a definition that you use when talking about people. It's when you talk about things. That situation was extraordinary. That piece of sculpture is remarkable. That's when you use the word egregious with that definition. Webster's second definition is really a bad definition. It says egregious means in a bad sense, greatly bad, extraordinarily bad. And that's when you use the word when you want to talk about a person. So when you say egregious about a thing or a situation, it's wonderful, it's great. When you say egregious about a person, it means it's a negative sense. Well, it's in today's dictionary, we've totally done away with the first definition totally. And now we use just the second definition, which is talking, shocking, you know, a person is shockingly bad. So there will be people who still use the word egregious as being extraordinary because they learned it then, they were familiar with it, may or may not know the difference between the good and the bad about something and about a person. But now we only have the one definition, which means something bad about a person. So it can get confusing, and there are lots of words that do that where people are still living with this definition and then there's this one. And egregious is a perfect example of what we can do, how the changing of definitions works.
Mm. That's fascinating, and it is such a confusing definition.
Correct. And so can you imagine there's other words out there that we are so familiar with in the legal world. You guys are familiar with that, but think about words that we're talking about that we don't even know. Somebody else has a total different meaning, and it could be the exact opposite of what we mean and what we say. And that's why we're having poor communication between people now.
Mm-hmm. Well, this has been fascinating, Dana. Can you tell our listeners how they can learn more about you?
Absolutely. You can actually go to my website, which is www.danalynnpope, so it's danalynnpope.com. You can follow me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter. Also, when you go on my website, there's a link there that you can go ahead and purchase my book, Who's Changing the Meaning?
And it's a book that I read and I found it fascinating. Thank you, Dana, for being part of the show. I really appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you, Pat, for having me. I love talking to you. I'm glad we had this time together.
And for our listeners, please be sure to tune in for next week's interview. And if you like this program and you like this podcast, please recommend it and share it with the people that you know who would be interested in learning more about some of the nuances of legal nurse consulting. Thanks for being a part of this program. Check out our online training and books at legalnursebusiness.com. Expand your LNC skills with our resources. Also, explore coaching with me at lncacademy.com to get more clients, make more money, and avoid expensive mistakes. And finally, join our continuing education program and get monthly trainings at lncceu.com. You'll get 2 online trainings each month designed to deepen your knowledge and skills. And look forward to having you tune into our programs again next week. Use the code LISTENED to get a 25% discount on this product. You'll put that code LISTENED in the coupon code box during checkout.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on legalnursebusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at lncacademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on iTunes. We always are interested in your ideas for new topics. Please leave a comment on legalnursepodcasts.com. Join our community and get notified of each new episode and receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on legalnursepodcasts.com. We appreciate you and your interest.